This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
It just takes a core of people that give a damn. I mean, they really say, you know, this matters to me. My grandchildren live here. My children live here. I love this community. And then they get out and then they start causing a problem.
Today's guests on Sea Change Radio both work behind the scenes fighting for ecological protection and innovation and amplify their message of progress through popular media. First, we hear from attorney and radio personality Mike Papantonio, who's known for his courtroom battles with large corporate polluters like Raytheon and BP, as well as his weekly Ring of Fire radio show, where he teams up with Robert F. Kennedy Jr. to entertain and educate. Next, we talk with activist and businesswoman Majora Carter, whose efforts to empower urban and low-income communities have dovetailed with television and radio appearances on the Sundance Channel, Public Radio, and the Discovery Channel. This week on Sea Change Radio, these two eco-warriors tell us about their work in the trenches and remind us that we can all make a difference. My guest today on Sea Change Radio is Mike Papantonio. He's a senior partner at Levin Papantonio in Pensacola, Florida. Listeners may also know Mike as the host of the nationally syndicated radio show Ring of Fire Radio, which he co-hosts with Robert F. Kennedy Jr. and David Bender. Mike, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Lunch, how are you?
Great to have you on the show. You're known by many as an opinionated political observer, but a lot of folks don't know about the environmental work you do, Mike. Can you tell our audience a little bit more about the Raytheon water case and give us a little bit more background on Raytheon as a company itself?
Yeah, Raytheon is best known as a defense kind of organization that gets huge, huge government contracts for building things like missiles. They built the Patriot missile. They build all types of radar systems. I think probably they get more money from taxpayers as a contractor, military contractor, than maybe any other company. So, but this was a company that was in the business of making, primarily satisfying government contracts, and they were down in around St. Petersburg. And what they had done is they knew, Raytheon knew, that they were releasing volatile organic compounds of virtually every kind. 1,4-dioxane, for example, extremely, extremely problematic, into the groundwater, okay? So they knew that, and they had, it was clear in their documents that they had a huge problem all the way back to 1991, and they covered it up. They kept it like this awful secret from everybody, even though the groundwater was moving below everybody's homes. And again, you know, this isn't just a minor problem. People were using, I mean, it was, some people had wells. They would use it to water their grass. They'd use it, the water, to have gardens. They'd fill their swimming pools with this water. Trichloroethylene is, you know, if you know the carcinogenic nature of that, it's one of the most carcinogenic volatile organic compounds that you'd want to list. But that was okay with this company. They did it anyway because they thought they could save money. But again,
and that's totally a money-saving issue as well, right? I mean, trichloroethylene is just a solvent to remove grease. There's obviously other ways to do that, right?
Of course. And certainly 1,4 dioxane, I mean, my God, to have that in the groundwater and know about it and say we're going to keep it quiet is unforgivable. But this is a company that had the same kind of history in Tucson, Tucson, Arizona. They disposed of metals, chlorinated solvents and substances around the plant, also taken up in the groundwater. But again, if you look at who this company is, you know, they have pumped vast amounts of money into influence peddling. I mean, you think Citizens United is kind of a new concept where corporations can spread as much money around as they want. That's a new concept. It's really not. They've spent millions and millions of dollars lobbying. And in exchange, they, for example, were given $152 million in grants. That's just from the National Science Foundation. And the point being here, we as taxpayers allow them to do the things that they do. And we would expect that they would do them responsibly, certainly in a way that would not cause harm, injury, poison the very people who are giving them the money. But they don't seem to worry about that. If you look at their history, 1990, they had to plead to felony counts for illegal obtaining classified Air Force budget planning documents. I mean, in other words, it was espionage in the truest sense. So they did that so they could fix bids. October, I think it was 1994, they paid $4 million to settle an inflated defense contract on anti-missile radar. It just goes on and on. 93, they had to pay about $3.5 million to settle a case where they misled the U.S. Defense Department by overstating the costs of the Patriot missiles. So when you look at this company, they're no different from the BP. I mean, we want to think that they're different because they don't look like thugs. They don't look like criminals because they're dressed up. They have Harvard MBAs. They talk, they don't talk like a street criminal, but they're criminals.
And how do they defend their criminal behavior across the board? It's usually we create jobs, right? And that's their get out of jail free card is, well, we're job creators. But at some point we have to ask ourselves, like, maybe these are the wrong type of jobs we're creating.
Right. Well, they create jobs, Alex. And what they do is they externalize all their costs. They say, okay, well, we're going to employ 1,000 people. But the trade-off is we want to come to your town and not pay any taxes. We want to come to your town and allow us to dump all of our poison in your waterways and dump all of our poison in your airways. And they shift those costs. They take it away from them to the taxpayer. And then when they leave town, the taxpayer has to figure out how to clean all that up. And it costs them billions to do that.
You're also involved in a class action suit against BP in the wake of the Gulf oil spill, which most of us know the basics about. But what kind of details are you learning as the suit evolves?
The big picture is that what we're dealing with is we're dealing with criminals. I mean, this is a company that really nobody has gone to prison for killing 15 people in Texas. They're in Texas City at the refinery explosion. They should have. They had to plead guilty to felonies, but nobody was taken off in handcuffs. In any other setting, in any other place in the world, the people who made those decisions should have gone, at least should have been indicted, and a jury should have heard the story. The same way with BP. I mean, the same way with the BP explosion that has destroyed an ecosystem, killed 11 people, and has probably, is going to result in about, I would say conservatively, $60 to $70 billion worth of losses just along the Gulf Coast. There, we look at the story. We know that this isn't just negligence. I mean, it wasn't just somebody who was stupid that allowed this to happen. It was a matter of acts all along the way that were so reckless that they could almost be equated to manslaughter. In other words, if you jump in a car and you drink a fifth of whiskey and you drive through a school zone and run over a child, that's manslaughter, and you go to prison for that. This is the same kind of analysis with the BP case. And unfortunately, the media misses that. It's almost like they're afraid to say it. Yeah, they're dressed up. They look different. They have a three-piece suit on. They have silk tie on. They don't look like a criminal, but they are criminals. And so that's usually the same scenario we see in virtually all of the environmental cases. Most people that are affected by one of these environmental cases would say, look, why don't you keep your money, BP, but give us the 20 people that are responsible for making this happen, and we'll put them in prison, just like we would any other criminal. Most people would be more than happy to say, yeah, we'll make that compromise, but we can't do that in corporate America nowadays because we have a Supreme Court that has become a lapdog, total lapdog for corporate America. They're not going to do anything that even holds corporate America responsible, much less punishes them in any way.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. My guest is Mike Papantonio. He's a lawyer with Levin Papantonio Law Firm in Pensacola, Florida, as well as the host of Ring of Fire Radio. Sea Change Radio tries to focus on solutions. What do you see as some of the solutions to a Raytheon? There's Raytheons in communities all across the country. How does a citizen who doesn't have a nationally syndicated radio show or a burgeoning legal practice, how do they get involved and do the right thing to try to make a change for the better in their communities?
Raytheon's a great example. Great example. Raytheon, you had a handful. People that said something's going on here, and they started demonstrating. And I think it started off with 5 or 6 demonstrators, and the media got the story, and the story got bigger and bigger. It's up to them. They can do what they need. They can accomplish what they need to accomplish. It just takes a core of people that give a damn. That really say, this matters to me. My grandchildren live here. My children live here. I love this community. And then they get out, and then they start causing a problem. We had the same thing happen up in Spelter, West Virginia with DuPont. A core of people said, this stuff's killing us. What you've done to this community is killing us, and we need to do something about it. So all of a sudden the media gets involved, and then it gets the attention of people who want to do something. So the point is, you've got to, you can never say that 5 or 6 people can't accomplish something. It's a matter, there's all kinds of ways. There's an emerging citizens media, Alex, and you're very familiar with this citizens media. Citizens media takes place on blogosphere. It takes place on doing videos, homegrown videos that you post on YouTube and all over the net. And then before you know it, those stories get legs on them. And so it's amazing what you can accomplish. It's just absolutely startling what you can accomplish with just having the focus to say, I'm going to do something. I tell attorneys all the time that, how dare you think that your job is done simply because you go to trial and win a case. Your job isn't done until you get the message out of what occurred, what happened there. What was the history? How do we avoid that happening again? And I tell them all the time, how much does it cost to get a handheld camera and a sound system and even a teleprompter if you want, and create your own items for video that if it's well done, if it's well thought out, it has huge impact all over the net. There's plenty to do. All we can do is understand all the nuances and all the facts, and all we can do is be willing to do what a guy like, think about, again, Ed Schultz. Ed Schultz, MSNBC, says, I think we need to have a rally. Progressives haven't done anything since Obama was inaugurated. We've done nothing. 2 years, progressives have done nothing. So let's have a one nation rally in Washington, D.C. And he started that. One person started that. And then he put the crew together, and that got bigger and bigger and bigger. So that does work, but you have to be willing to kind of hang in there.
Can you tell us a little bit about how Ring of Fire got started? Because a lot of us have kind of picked up the dialogue midstream.
Yeah, Bobby Kennedy and I have tried cases together for a lot of years, and we really started recognizing that the cases that we were trying, whether it was environmental, primarily environmental, all kind of had a social responsibility aspect. There was no way to separate the case from the politics and the social overlays that affect that case. In other words, the environmental movement in America is dependent on us being politically active, not just active in the courtroom. It also requires that we become socially active. It doesn't solve anything that we go to trial and we hit DuPont for $500 million or Conoco for $150 million. That doesn't accomplish in and of itself what we need to accomplish. What we need to do is change the landscape of politics and change the landscape of social issues. And so what we did is we launched a show called Ring of Fire, and it was launched during the same time that Air America was launched. They asked us to come on and do our show there. That was about 9 years ago. And we've done it solidly for 9 years. It's a broadly syndicated program. And I think it all came out of a recognition that, you know, we have certain skills. We have certain things that we have been able to accomplish as attorneys. But we need to take that and kind of put it back out there and make it work for the whole community.
So, Mike, if listeners want to go to ringoffireradio.com, they can find out where it's broadcast. Mike Papantonio, thanks for being our guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you, Alex. I appreciate it.
How does one decide that the method is you? They just won't jive. Truly believing and trying over and over again. Living in hopes that someday he'll be in with the wind of.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, any place, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
My guest today on Sea Change Radio is Majora Carter. She is a local economic development consultant, president of the Majora Carter Group. She's founded the nonprofit Sustainable South Bronx. Recently, she was named one of the 100 most creative people in business by Fast Company magazine. And she's also the host of Eco Heroes on the Sundance Channel. Majora, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks for having me, Alex.
Majora, a lot of people have heard of the homeland security. What is hometown security?
Hometown security is an overall national plan that we are trying to push. And it really simply means that you can solve local problems, big local problems, with local solutions. And by that I mean that you can use the same type of money to support both job creation as well as the kind of infrastructure costs that all municipalities have to deal with, whether it's in stormwater management, waste management, etc. And so for us, it's how do you look at the creation of those types of jobs and really use the development of the needs that we have in order to create jobs. For example, in many coastal areas, you know, there is a huge amount of an understanding at this point in research that shows that in coastal areas in this country, there's going to be sea level rise, and that we have to think about how you develop and help those communities adapt to the changing climate. And so we are thinking, and we also know that in many of those places, those are very poor communities in a lot of cases. And so creating jobs around climate adaptation to help those communities and cities be more resilient not only helps them deal with what we know is coming, you know, down the pipes in terms of stormwater management, you know, dealing with more intense storm surges and sea level rise, but it also would create a whole new workforce of people that are doing those climate adaptation, that work, you know, whether it's, repairing and restoring bulkheads so that they're in changing communities so that we can make them more resilient, creating wetlands and restoring wetlands that many of them have been destroyed, you know, over the past several decades in our country. And since we know that those areas are often poor, you create these jobs that would allow the same folks that are currently on the tax burden side to become part of the tax base.
And from a policy standpoint, where do you think we're falling short and what needs to be done to actuate the kind of change you're talking about?
Interestingly enough, I think that we actually have an enormous amount of the resources that are available already. You know, it's just a matter of how do you allocate resources. I mean, every municipality has some kind of budget, you know, whether it's for all of the social costs that, you know, poverty brings, you know, whether it's incarceration or public health benefits or welfare benefits, et cetera. And they also have budgets, you know, for infrastructure as well, you know, stormwater and waste handling management, you know, things of that nature. But where there is not an enormous amount of effort actually considered to figuring out how you can use some of those same dollars in order to create change on both of those fronts. And, you know, because again, if you are hiring people, personal training them and then hiring them to do some of this water cultural infrastructure work, whether it's urban forestry management, wetland restoration, doing those things in urban and rural areas, then you're automatically moving them, you know, and opening the door for them to not be a tax burden, but you're moving them into the realm of being part of a tax base. And again, by doing that, you're supporting the local economy. But if you're only thinking about, we just need to build, you know, even bigger, better sewage treatment plants, you know, in order to manage this, then you're, what you're doing is also keeping, you know, and continuing to depreciate the quality of life for folks who actually could be a part of a workforce if by chance we used and really implemented horticultural infrastructure projects in our cities and also in our rural areas.
And how do we link those two, the urban and the rural horticultural infrastructures, so to speak? How, because that's one of the keys, is to make sure that they're not isolated, right?
Right, and they're not. You know, what happens, you know, what happens upstream, you know, comes downstream. You know, the fact that there is all sorts of issues related to agricultural runoff that actually do, you know, in rural areas, that do come into urban areas. The fact that, you know, our food system is connected, you know, to agricultural areas, and, you know, we're seeing the impact of that, you know, whether it's from, you know, petroleum-based fertilizers in our food and to the rise of obesity, all related, you know, to the fact that there is a connection between rural and urban. But one of the things that we're really interested in working to actually to literally bring that together is the development of a national brand of urban grown produce that we are working on that would create opportunities for urban micro agribusiness, you know, in our cities. So the idea would be to create in-city growing, you know, whether in greenhouses or actually even in, you know, in many of the cities around the country that have a 20% vacancy rate already, you know, building, you know, very highly energy efficient growing systems in warehouses would be one way to do it as well. We even know some folks that are interested in growing aquaponically, and that's the act of growing in water as opposed to in the ground or even in raised beds. So that, and interestingly enough, aquaponic growing on the same amount of square footage or acreage, you can grow about 10 times the amount aquaponically or hydroponically rather in the same amount of traditional farming space. So we are really interested in seeing how you can do that in cities in order to support and really supplement the work that regional growers in urban, in rural areas are doing. Because from our research, even, let's take example of New York, for example, even if all of the regional growers aggregated every single bit of food that they did, they still wouldn't be able to meet the demand for the local food that is actually desired in the New York metropolitan area. But by creating in-city growing opportunities, you know, in greenhouses or in warehouses, and by doing that, we can actually create a consistent enough amount of produce that could feed some of the demand by institutions in metropolitan areas. So the hospitals, the schools, the daycare and senior centers, even the correction facilities could be fed that way. And again, because those type of institutions don't just want what you find at a farmer's market. They often just want, you know, a set amount of a bunch of food, of produce that, and they want it and they need it, a consistent supply. So by creating those types of linkages where the ability to create 12 months out of the year growing for a region or local food, you know, not only it creates jobs, you know, and a steady supply of produce, that, but also helps create what is truly a local food system in our communities where local dollars stay in our local economies.
How do people who live in the suburbs get involved in the program besides voting for politicians who are going to put forth policies that will accelerate this kind of change?
You know, I think that there's going to be at some point a way for folks to, you can vote with your dollars, you know, obviously, but I think in terms of developing a truly local food system, you know, we have to be aware of the reality of the situation. You know, farmers markets are great, community gardens are great, but in terms of the numbers and stuff that they actually can support, you know, that's really not going to be it. What would be, I think, really helpful is folks pushing, you know, their local regulatory agencies, electives, et cetera, to really start thinking about, where, at least for institutions, which are in general are often the biggest employers of places, they can even be corporate dining rooms, but definitely the hospitals, the schools, that making sure that stuff is brought from local sources. I mean, college campuses have been tremendous, in terms of, having an engaged, group of folks, demanding from their administrations that their food be local. That's one of the reasons why you're seeing that change, across the country. And I think where folks are, wherever they are, they can do the same things for the other institutions that they either frequent or support, through their tax dollars. And that's a really powerful thing to do and accept that things can happen.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about the work you did with Sustainable South Bronx?
I like to think of Sustainable South Bronx as my research and development lab for environmentally and economically just the sustainable projects for an environmental justice community. South Bronx, where I was born and raised and still live, was a regional sacrifice zone in terms of the type of facilities that were cited for the neighborhood, waste facilities, power plants, sewage sludge, pelletizing plants, and it was done mostly because it was a politically easy place to put those type of things that wealthier communities could afford to avoid. And so my purpose of starting Sustainable South Bronx was to show that you could actually create environmental and economic solutions that supported not only the quality of life of people in a local community, but also that by doing so, it would actually support the larger municipality. And basically, those projects kind of cover hometown security, which is a platform that we're creating that really does describe that you can create local, that there are local solutions to all of our big problems and how you create jobs and sustainability in our local areas is basically how you're going to save America.
Majora Carter, the local economic development consultant behind the Majora Carter Group. Majora, we really appreciate you being our guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thanks, Alex.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Alphonse Mouzon, Freddie King, and Alan Toussaint. Sea Change Radio is made possible by support from Sungevity Solar Home Specialists and Invisible Structures, a porous paving company. Go to Sungevity.com and InvisibleStructures.com to learn more. Check out our website at SeaChangeRadio.com. That's SEAChangeRadio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.